I went home and wired it into my hi-fi and all this kind of stuff, and it was this proud moment. And I'll tell you what, he sounded brilliant for about 30 seconds.
Oh, and hello, welcome to Not an Audiophile, episode 13. Hey, Not an Audiophile is really somewhat different to other podcasts because everyone that we have on is a industry professional of some kind or another. And today we're interviewing another industry professional, although he was very much a customer and decided, hey, I'm not going to buy another amplifier, I'm going to build one. Today we're speaking to Gary Wise at I don't know the name of the company. Is it Clio, or how do you pronounce
Clio.
It? It is Clio.
So yeah, I'll pronounce it Clio.
It's as simple as that, then, is it?
It is. Yeah, I've heard it called everything. Clio, Telio.
Yes.
Clio.
Well, but isn't that your fault? I mean, you from what I've read,
I can take responsibility for that.
Well, you know, it's got something to do with Greek mythology. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I was struggling to find a name, and I remember looking at all these books of saying, "Oh, how to name a business," and it was sort of, "Oh, I have something memorable," and then should I find something which, you know, relates to music and all this kind of stuff. And then I started looking at all these brands, and some of them are so predictable with their names. And I thought, oh, do you know what? Started reading this sort of Greek mythology website, and I thought, oh, that looks kind of right. That would be quite nice. And I ran it past my wife, who's sort of the boss, and she said, oh, yeah, that sounds good. Let's go do it. So there we are. And I thought it was quite good, actually, 5 letters.
Well, that's right. I mean, it looks good. I mean, and look, it is pronounced apparently the way I thought it would be, but I initially thought, yeah, Clio, and then there's a little twist there with the extra letter, but anyhow, no, that's great. So let's introduce you properly. Gary, you many years ago now, really, in a way, from what I am led to believe, so at least 9 or 10 years ago, decided that you wanted to be
14
in the
years, really.
You decided you wanted to be in the hi-fi business, which is a noble idea, but you've obviously gone about it in a very methodical way. Although I'm led to believe you've actually had the preamp and the integrated amp on the market for a while. Can you tell us a little bit about that? But let you answer that. Let's say you are very proud of the fact that the product is not just designed but manufactured in I was going to say the UK, and I guess it is the UK, not just England. I guess you might have stuff from, you know, over the border, but you can tell us about that. But that's part of it, and it's a brand that perhaps the listeners have not heard of until now. But I came across it sort of somewhere on Instagram, I think, and I just loved the look, the styling, and I love the...
Cheers.
Well, I felt as if this had some serious bones underneath the casework, and I guess the fact that it's machined from solid was maybe gave me that feeling. But look, tell me all about it. How did this start?
I think I had a moment of insanity, I think, trying to join the hi-fi industry.
But we're a friendly bunch of people, right?
Oh, well, I'm discovering mostly that along the way. So.
Mostly.
There's the odd one. It's a long story, to be honest, and I think if I got paid for every time I've told this, I'd probably have quite a lot of money behind me now.
Well.
Basically, you never know, not huge amounts. It all kind of started around 2010, to be honest. My wife went to uni as a mature student.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a choice. We got married quite young, and then she fancied going to do a degree, which was
fair enough.
Really good, really supportive of that. And I was in the process of kind of looking at upgrading the hi-fi, which I'd had since about 2005. That was like my first proper system, which we can chat about in a bit if you like. And I had an MF80 integrated amp, and it didn't have a headphone socket. And I started like oh, I need to get a headphone amp for this amplifier. You know, it's really bugging me. And I started, you know, doing the research, you know, like us hi-fi enthusiasts do, start looking at all the different brands. And then I was trying to set budget of how much I wanted to spend. And you go down a rabbit hole. And I think one day, I said to her, I'm not sure how much the money to spend on this headphone amp. And she was, I think I was doing her head in, to be honest. She said, can't you just buy one? Like, make your own or something. It was just some flippant comment.
Make your own or something. Oh, okay.
Make your own. Yeah.
And an open invitation.
Exactly, yeah. And I thought, maybe I could get a kit from eBay or something like that. I don't know, some kind of random thing. But I'm one of these guys who sort of goes all in with something. And I started looking at building headphone amps and headphone amp design. And my brother-in-law, he kind of has tinkered around with electronics through the years. And he's not a pro, but, you know, he's good at a schematic and he can put something together.
Okay.
And we kind of just had these odd conversations. And this is how the story evolves. The next thing, you know, he said to me, oh, I've got this. I said, what about if we just make like a integrated amp with a headphone socket instead, if we're going to all this effort of, you know, kind of building something out of a little kit? And he was like, oh, why don't you read this book of power amplifier design by Douglas Self.
that book. Yeah. Okay.
And I was like, well, I haven't got a clue about anything to do with this, but I thought, you know, sounds fun. Let's have a little read. I could have got a page in. I was like, I don't understand this. So chuck that to the side.
Yep.
And then we just ended up this thing of like, actually, forget the headphone amp, push that to the side. Let's try and make our own integrated. And that was probably my downfall, because that was where we all started. It was a brave move. From there... Sorry, Andrew.
Yeah. No, all I was going to say is, on the basis that you, in your range of products, to skip ahead, you don't have a headphone amplifier yet, you still haven't
no,
got...
No, I can't... No, there isn't one. Project Headbox.
But I actually... and there is,
ironically.
There is no headphone socket on your integrated either, is there?
No, there isn't, no.
So you haven't really you haven't really got around to your headphone amp yet. But let's go back to the story, though. So,
fine. So, no, basically, I kind of, you know, we worked together and tried to do a few bits. And then in the end, my brother-in-law, he kind of sort of like, oh, I don't think I can help you with what you want. You know, I'm not really good at designing stuff. And I was kind of left. I'd got this passion to kind of do something at this point. And I thought, do you know what? In for a penny, in for a pound. I'm just going to email this Douglas Self guy. You know, really understanding. I'm just going to email him and see what he can, if he does any sort of freelance work. So I kind of chanced it, and I got a reply back within 24 hours and said, yeah, I do some consultancy.
Hang on, whoa, just slow down for a second. So you've got the Douglas Self guide to how amplifiers should work, and I forget the name of the book, but is it the classic text, I presume?
Yeah.
Which I thought was written like in the 70s?
A long time ago.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So you go, I'm reading this book from the 70s.
Yep.
I'll ring up the author. He seems to know what he's talking about. And of course, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
He certainly does, right? So, and you get him on the email within 24 hours.
Yeah, and I think there's this thing. There's this big level of, like, God-tier kind of engineers in the world. But what everyone forgets is everyone's just people. They're all humans. They're all trying to earn a living. And it's sort of, you can't contact that person. They're sort of one of the top leading hi-fi engineers. And it's like, well, audio engineers, you know, you just go, well, I think he wants to make a living like we all do. So that's
I'm completely impressed.
Send you an email.
Yeah. And what you say is, of course, completely right. But it's just... I mean, I think the thing is, the legend of that name when it comes to amplifier design is such that I don't know, you've impressed me. I mean, how? Well, I mean, you've impressed me as much. I'm impressed two ways. One that you, I'll just do this. And then I'm secondarily completely impressed that you got this very fast response to your email. So what path did you go down then?
Well, so then we kind of, you know, it was all kind of business-like, really, and sort of, you know, how do we, what do you want to make? I said, I don't really know, to be honest. He said, like a pre-power combo. And I was like, yeah. And I said, I was just going to go for an integrated. And he kind of sowed the seed of, well, you could, you know, it depends how flexible you make your design.
Yeah.
You could use the preamp from one of them and just, you know, then have the power amp side separate and put it in one case. Unfortunately, we did quite well. We got all the spec done. Got a lot of block diagrams working. But then we kind of, I don't want to say fell out. That would be the wrong word. Yeah. I'm obviously very respectful. But I think there was an element of, I was very determined in what I wanted to make. This had to be an all-British product,
yes,
made in the UK. And we kind of got into the level of, let's do lots of expensive prototyping in China. Let's do lots of stuff here. And it kind of, I didn't have the budget to kind of support that. And I kind of felt a bit swept away. I just sort of said, okay, well, thanks for everything you've done. Let's kind of park things for now while I sort of assess where we are. So I kind of did my own research locally to find some guys who could do some sort of PCB layout and manufacturing and all these kind of things. And I bumped into a bunch of guys who I would say took me where I need to go. Okay. And it's kind of ironic because I rung them up and they said, oh, we'll come round and let's have a conversation. I said, well, I haven't got an office. I work from my dining room table at the moment. And they said, oh, it doesn't matter. So just, they came round and they sat down and, you know, it was all really nice. They had a cup of tea and, you know, some biscuits and, you know, classic stuff. And it was really good. And they walked away and they said, what would you actually want to do? And I said, well, this is what I'm doing. And this is what I want to do. I want it to be all made in the UK and all this kind of thing. I had all my passion and, you know,
You hadn't had your passion beaten out of you yet by reality.
Not yet. No. That came many years later. But no. So we kind of went back and forth and they said to me, right, I can see what you're trying to do. They went away. Obviously, they took some stuff away of them and had a thing. We signed an NDA and all that kind of stuff. And they went, Gary, to be honest, I think we can help you out of this.
Okay.
Our MD, John, he's done a little bit of work in the audio side. He's not a top end audio engineer, but we think we can deliver you exactly what you want. What do you think? And I said, you know what? I'm one of these guys who gets led by their gut instinct as well, to be honest.
Of course.
And they really read the room well.
Yeah, okay.
And I said, okay, when I get some money, let's see if we can do something. And I've got a couple of grants, you know, nothing major, sort of £1,500 here and there. As part of like a UK manufacturing kind of thing. And I gave them this brief to kind of design this preamp with all of the necessary PCBs associated with input selection and like a processor board for the volume control. And we spec'd it all out and they took some of the work, a lot of spec level stuff, which I wanted to incorporate from the work I did with Douglas. And they said, all right, okay, fine. Let's see what we come up with. And that was kind of mid 2013 at this point.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
And around, time goes.
Yeah. Time whizzes past.
And I got to, it was just before, it was before Christmas in 2013. And they said, Gary, we've got you a working prototype.
Wow. Okay. I was like, that's a hell of a Christmas present.
Do you want to come and collect it? And I was like, yeah, okay. So I go down in my car and drive down to Folkestone, which is on the Kent coast.
Yep.
And they give him this box. It was like a fruit box. You know, where you get like apples and pears. And in it, there's all these, this big plastic grated sort of thing with a load of, I'll send you a picture. And it just had a load of PCBs.
Yeah, please do send a picture. So various
PCBs just... Yeah,
various aspects of the designs, sort of, I was going to say hot melt glued together. But zip tied.
And it was all very rough and kind of stuff. And I went home and wired it into my hi-fi and all this kind of stuff. And it was this proud moment. And I'll tell you what, it sounded brilliant for about 30 seconds. with static feedback and all that kind of stuff. And I rung him up and I said, played it for about 30 seconds. It sounds great. I said, but then he started doing this. And they said, oh, don't worry, bring it back down. We'll have a look at that. And they did it. And next, you know, it came back with all these wires kind of all over the place. But funny enough, he came back the second time.
Yeah.
And it played brilliantly. Okay. We had it on I use it as my main system. So you had to it didn't have a power on switch. You had to plug straight into the main.
Plug in the wall,
All that kind of stuff. But it was great. And I kind of thought, I've got something here. which I can work with. I forgot to say as well, we kind of, the power amp side of things, we had to kind of look to outsource that because the main focus was going to be on the preamp stage and making that really good. Yeah. So we went to Ice Power in the end.
Okay.
Because they, well, no, it ruffles a few feathers here, but I think what gets misconstrued is that as a manufacturer, you need someone who's going to work with you. And it's very well people say, oh, go to Purify, go to Hypex, go to all these brands who I, you know, probably shouldn't name. But it's about how does the customer service work?
Well, you named the other two Class D amplifier module makers. That's fine. Everyone knows who they are.
Yeah. So you kind of, it's for me, it's like, how, what's my relationship like? What's my account manager like? How do I get technical support? And how that was good. And it was phenomenal. And to be fair to Ice Power, I'm not trying to do a promo here, but they said, oh, we'll fly someone else to work with your guys if we need to, and all this kind of stuff. And and it was really good. So I've got some sort of loyalty there with this product, but they really helped me out in the early stages.
So is that are you dealing with Denmark, or where does the Ice Power thing happen?
Yeah, so I deal with them direct in Denmark.
Yeah, okay.
Which is
cool. You know, that's good. And there's nothing, I think that, you know, you say ruffle a few feathers, but I mean, I think that people are both customers who want to buy audio products who are, you know, are enthusiasts and know what Class D is, or what they think they know what it is. And many manufacturers, of course, it's swinging that way. And I suspect we're not more than 10 years away from a bit of a Class D invasion, I think, as more and more people realise it now sounds pretty damn good, and I think any reliability issues that may have been there. I mean, we're talking 20 years ago, really. I think for the and you're talking actually 10 years ago. So I mean, I guess those modules have been improved since then, anyhow. But you were getting great sound 10 years ago. You're saying.
Yeah, definitely, 100%. And that was good. So, I mean, back to the kind of where we were. So we did a kind of, so we had our...
So you had a good lash-up prototype was sounding great.
That was great. And then we moved on to a sort of a few refinements from there.
Okay.
Kind of like, how can we make this a bit better? You know, so kind of, I kind of had like a tape loop in there at one point. So I took that out and moved up the PCB to get an extra set of sort of XLRs in there as well.
Yeah.
And kind of just reinvented it. I wanted it kind of stripped back to an extent.
Yeah.
And I used my Musical Fidelity X80 as my little, I know it's a budget amplifier, but it was kind of, it was very basic. It had, few RCA ins and, like a record link and a kind of out, and that was it really. But it was like the heart of the system, so I kind of wanted to replicate that in a way.
Yeah.
And then we can't say from a hardware perspective, that was the sound. We just, I kind of was happy with it. Thought, yeah, it sounds fine. It sounds fine indoors. And
what ingredients in the preamp do you think, or what? Was there a philosophy, and I'm guessing the philosophical aspects of the design probably come back to the initial conversations with Douglas Self, I would assume, rightly.
I spoke to Douglas about it, and that was kind of, you know, relay switching, nice short circuit paths and things like that.
Okay.
I fed all that onto my guy, John, and he was very much like, absolutely fine, let's do this.
Yep.
He had some experience with certain relays and things and components which worked well with some other things he's done, and said, I suggest we use these brands and things. So I think it's Panasonic and Panasonic relays and all these.
Well, you can hardly go wrong there.
Exactly, yeah. And so it's kind of, it's good stuff. So,
and that was, so the goal being there was, you know, less concerned with cost and more concerned with, of course, reliability and sound quality. Is that,
definitely, 100%.
And what about the volume? And I don't get into bogged down in fine details because I'm no expert, but was there something about the volume control circuit, the way that you dealt with that was key?
I used to live in a terrace house. So not sure what the house is like in Australia, but basically
expensive,
a sort of house
mostly,
on the side of the
house.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So pretty much the same as your houses, really, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Very expensive over here. And it was this thing of, I used to listen to music in the evening when I came home from work, and I'd be sitting working on Clio in my dining room at sort of like 8:30 in the evening.
Yes.
Excuse me. And basically, to not annoy my neighbours, it was always that thing of, like, how do I get the volume quite right? And it was okay on a sort of what you call like an old-fashioned knob where you could just tweak it.
Just touch it,
tiny bit.
Tenth of a millimetre kind of thing.
And you get, without the sound being impacted too much. But I was really, what I really wanted with Clio, and I'm trying to cover so many bases with this product, I've probably exhausted it all, but it was, how can I have it still sounding good at 10 o'clock at night whilst not winding my neighbours up?
Yeah. Yep.
So it was kind of, the volume in its own is 256 positions on that digital encoder.
Is it really? Right. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's a Bourne's one.
Yeah.
But what we've done, we've made the software work in a way that for the first 1/3 of the volume control, it's very small increments. Okay.
Oh, so okay. So is it? It's a motorized pot, then, is it? Is it?
No, it's digital.
It's a digital attenuator. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's a very, very fine level of very fine. Segments, but yeah, very. I mean, so what I was going to say, half a dB, but you're talking a tenth of a dB at lower levels or something. Is that the?
Something like that. So it's got the first few notches are quite small. I mean, as you get to over like a third of the way, the lights increase a bit more in the volume you're getting. I mean, when you get over the final third, they're sort of bigger chunks. And it's just so that you can have a little bit more control.
Yeah. At lower levels.
In what I call the everyday distinct kind of environment. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. Okay, so then when I guess you've got the basic, you've got basically the sound and the feature set, and obviously someone's got to design a proper circuit board. But then at that point, you've got to think about what case you're putting it in. So how did you end up with the whole concept of CNC milling out of a billet of solid aluminium? What was the thought there?
That was me being overly ambitious again.
okay.
So took a bit of inspiration from a 2010 iMac I had sitting around in my study at the time, and that was kind of a bit of a thing at the time, sort of, you know, Apple using these big chunks of aluminium, and then there was obviously other brands which had done stuff. I think of back in the time, you know, like Jeff Rowland sort of design group. They kind of had that wavy front panel with the machine from Solid and stuff, and I kind of like that. But with the whole Class D thing, we could get away without having loads of ventilation holes and all them kinds of things. And I know this sounds controversial, but I needed a design which kind of my wife would be happy with it within the lounge. I couldn't have something which was going to be like big heat sinks and, you know, takes up the size of a, you know, got bedside table, you know, in there, and costs the earth to run. It was kind of like, for me, hi-fi music should be sort of integral into the whole family environment. So, you know, it's just a really good sounding box. It looks cool and it sits in the rack or whatever. And that's great, you know. And maybe if you're having an argument about, oh, what should we buy this one? It's like, well, actually, I prefer this one. It might be a bit easier to flex your credit card if it looks right.
So. I think that, I mean, that's a very real world line of thinking, and probably...
Yeah.
Is a thought that doesn't enter too many mid to high end hi-fi designers' consciousness, but probably should, because actually it's not just about the so-called sort of silly expression wife acceptance factor, but it's also it's real world. You don't want it to be, you don't want it to look like a piece of machinery in a way, and clearly you've avoided that, and it's a very attractive industrial design, which we'll get to in a second. But your thought was that you kind of like the hewn from Solid look and feel, but I guess there's a precision advantage, you know, as far as casework. Is that something that you were keen on as well?
No, it wasn't really about the precision, I don't think. It was just a case of I wanted to make something that look really good and would be a sort of like a statement in that way.
Yeah, okay.
And it was then a case of how do I get what sort of design do I want? I actually, a lot of that design was probably 80% myself, because I used to have this book, which sounds pretty sad now, but I used to have this green book. I still got it downstairs, and it's got like a notebook, and it's just got all of my little ideas for the business and how I was going to do it. And I'd have these little drawings, which I'd just like sketch out on a pen, and I thought, oh, that looks cool. No, that looks nice. Let's try and make that. And kind of all these different ideas.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. One day it might be worth some money, you know, someone could buy it off me if I like that. But it was just, I kind of evolved this way of thinking. And I had the seven LEDs down the side, and I had the volume on the left because normally it's on the right. And it's just kind of like, I just tried to mix things up a bit, really.
Hmm.
So I sent them off I got in touch with an industrial designer who'd done some work for, a lot of work in the professional industry, really, regarding sort of lighting desks and sound desks and things like that. So,
yeah, okay.
I kind of wanted to work with someone like that as opposed to just solely, we'd make lovely aesthetic things for the home. And that was a good relationship. And I basically took all my parts down there and said, John, this is what another John. Yeah, this is what we need. And he said, right, okay. This is my little sketch. What do you want to do? And he came back and he sent me these eight ideas, and some of them were awful and some of them were great. And in the end, I said, this is my best one. Can you, and he said, I was trying to explain to him what I wanted, and I'm a very visual person. So I fired up the computer, opened the file, hacked it around a bit and said, take this bit out, put this here. I ended up with that sort of keyhole shape thing on where the volume is, which everyone says, oh, have you copied that from Quad? No, it was just basically I was trying to combine the volume lights with the input select button and the logo within the same section. So
yeah,
it just kind of just naturally evolved like that. So I kind of ended up with that. And then it was like, right, okay, fine. Let's get some prototyping done. So then we had some first stage prototypes of the casework.
Okay.
But that in its own has been a journey.
I think people who have not tried to make something out of nothing also realize, I hope they do at least, just how much work. I mean, work, it's not really work in a way, is it? I mean, it's you wouldn't call it work, but it does absorb an enormous amount of time and thought, though. So how long would you say that it took to kind of get the casework worked out? Was it 6 months or a year, or was it not so bad?
The casework was pretty good. We got that done quite quickly.
Okay.
I'd say probably took about 6 to 9 months in total by the time we worked out all the tolerances and all that kind of stuff.
Still, quite a project though, right? That's,
yeah, definitely. And it's all time bound because I'm obviously sending a part back to a machine shop who are then working on some updated drawings who then need to slot that into their production process.
Yep.
Will then say, okay, well, we're going to do it this week and you should have it back by, like, I don't know, 2 weeks' time or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So before you know it, time can run away very, very quickly.
Indeed.
Without even realising. That is a bit of a thing. But I think more than casework, this is an issue we've dealt with even recently, is finishing. Trying to get something finished properly is just the biggest challenge in the business. Casework, easy. PCBs and electronic design, not a problem. Getting someone to do something consistently at a good
consistently,
price.
Consistently is, yeah. Well at a good price, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
well, a price where you can actually sell the thing for a sensible price when it's completed. There's so many little component parts to this whole package.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's changed, but you're not the only problem. Years ago I was at NAME, having a bit of a tour around there, and there was one particular room where they sort of had a lot of casework, a lot of front panels, and I said, oh, well, what happens here? Well, this is where we run QC over all of the front panels and the lids,
right.
And reject rate was quite high. Yeah. So look, we are talking small stuff. Don't get me wrong. These were things that they showed me a few examples of things that didn't pass. And I mean, you know, they were pretty subtle. But they, of course, if you spending £15,000 on an amplifier, the casework has to be perfect. Your price range, $5,000, it's still got to be perfect. There's no it's good enough. It's just, particularly when you consider that every iPhone that comes out of the iPhone factory is perfect, and it's not that kind of money. So getting back to, so you spent 9 months getting the casework right. So what is the finish? So you've got, it's some kind of a aluminium grade. We don't know and probably don't care. But obviously it's something that machines nicely and finishes nicely. And then... So then you've got different colours available. What is that?
We've had a bit of an evolution on finish. So we used to use, when we started, we used a sort of powder coat, which was kind of industrial, and it came out consistently.
Yes.
And that was great. That was fine. But then we had issues with a limited colours and availability. That was one challenge. Alongside this kind of all relates, Andrew. So what happened was, my dad is involved with, he's retired now, but he was involved with machining of stuff. He was like an engineer, but he didn't do this type of work. And we had a dinner table conversation, and he said, in his kind of fatherly way, sort of, how much are you paying for that unit? And I said, gave him the price. And he said, you're paying too much. And I was like, oh, really? He said, yeah, whatever suppliers, you're getting that from, they're putting a little bit of margin on there for you. And this is all my learning curve of, being working in this manufacturing field. And he said, I'll put you in touch with someone who can do that cheaper. And I was like, okay, here we go. So I spoke to some guys.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, come down with all your stuff and we'll have a look. And bear in mind, I'd working with models at this point, all this kind of stuff. And they said, I think we should change that base plate, and we should change that rear, and we should do this, and we could put a bit more thickness in here. And I think if you had this and it. So I said, okay, how much is this going to cost me? Yeah. Whilst they're sort of, mucking around with or extra ideas. And they said, no, we'll do it as a deal. If you do. We do these mods for you. We'll cover the cost if you do like a 4-off production. So it was like, okay, fine. I could do 4 in my stock. That'd be good. So we did that. But what these guys had done, in a fairly positive way, they tightened everything up. The tolerances have gone up an extra notch. So we kind of closed the gap. And everything was sort of, someone used the term, almost mosquito's penis size kind of tolerance. And it was great because everything really was, there was no gap on any as any parts went together. But then we had a challenge of, okay, so that's brilliant, but how am I going to end up, I can't get this powder coated now because I've got all this,
no, because it's too fine a tolerance,
it's too thick.
So
we went round the houses, and a friend of mine who'd done some work for us before, he said, I think what you're looking for is you need like a paint type finish, but with the actual, like, with no tolerance. And I said, well, okay, have you got any ideas? And he said, yeah, I think you should look at Cerakote, which is some sort of American product they use on guns and a whole host of things. In fact, I later found out a really top end American speaker manufacturer actually use Cerakote, but they don't advertise it. I kind of done some work with these guys, and that's where we are now. We use a Cerakote finish. It's really tough. It hasn't got any. You can use the same tolerances as we've got, which are really tight, but you don't have to take them into account. So that's where we sort of found our.
So it's not anodizing, or is the process similar? Is it a chemical process, or is it a paint?
It's they call it a coating. They sort of use a fine kind of. We have to use as well as the when we did the EMC testing, there were some requirements for metal to metal contact to boost up the sort of containerization of all of the signals and all that kind of stuff. So what we did, we had to make sure there was good metal to metal contact. So we have all of the parts dipped in iridite, which is a kind of like anti-corrosive coating, so that the bare aluminium doesn't tarnish over time and keeps up the good levels for EMC. But then, so then with the Cerakote, what they do, they mask up all of them areas, and then they blast it with like a really fine sort of sand. And then you get like a, just like a, it's not a rough, it's like a rough finish, but it's not in a way. It looks rough, but it's smooth.
Well, it cleans up. It sort of, prepares it. I mean, it's a great preparation blasting like that. It gives a nice even finish, you know. So that's, I mean, with a touch of texture to it, does it? Or is it like very fine texture?
It's one of them ones you can sort of see the texture.
Yeah.
You can't actually feel it.
So
then what they do then, they then put this coating over it. But it's quite clever in that if you want it glossy, you can put the high gloss layer in. If you want it matte, you can do that. If you want to kind of, you can sort of just make up like a wizard or something, make up your own kind of potions. I want a bit of cauldron, you put in a bit more metallic finish in there and a bit of high gloss hardener in there and stuff. And that's what they do. And then the standard colours I've got on the website are just for ones from their thingy. But we can kind of tweak it, sort of, that black looks nice, but you can have a bit more metallic in it as well. So we've got the standard colours listed, but we use we put a little bit more metallic in it, so you get a kind of more reflection on the black. I just didn't want a standard matte black box sitting in my lounge, you know, that kind of we've done that. Whether people like it or not, you know, it's always subjective to different tastes.
And of course it's a very permanent finish, and
which of course
is from, you know, is clearly one of your key goals, that you're making things that will literally last a lifetime. I guess is what you're angling at. So I've got I had a question which I'm just checking my notes, and I don't. No, well, actually, I did have a kind of a question about the team of people that you surround yourself with, and you've really found all of these skilled people who are obviously leaders in their little area of manufacturing.
Yeah.
And I'm slightly jealous because I always feel like there's a lot of manufacturing going on in the UK, and that you've got these people. Excuse me. You've got these people doing high quality work, and these people are mostly in Kent, which is where you,
yes,
where you, yeah, you're in. Is it Faversham?
So I'm in Faversham, which is sort of like the north.
The northern, Kent, yeah, the top coast, end, the top.
Yeah,
it's still not far from London, though, is it? Really? I mean,
no. It's about an hour on the train.
Yeah. So yeah, not a long way out. But these subcontractors, if we. Lower their call them that. They're all sort of handy, are they? They're sort of there's no one that's at the other end of the country that you're using as such, or is it?
No, the only, if I look at sort of component supply, the bit of, it's not plastic. It's actually glass, a bit like you get on like a iPhone screen.
Yeah.
But it's that comes from Berkshire.
Okay.
Which is, you know, not far north of London or to the west of London. And to be honest, that's the supplier who's the furthest away from our base.
Is that
everything
right?
Else. Yeah, everything else is done in Kent. So
this is not it's not just a UK
eight
product.
8 miles from my house.
Is that right? So it's not just a UK product.
Yeah.
It's a Kent product.
Yes, basically.
Isn't Kent kind of known for both... Is it more about gardens and flowers or something? And of course, I think you grow it. You grow a lot of because I'm a bit of a beer guy. Yeah, a lot of hops, right? So yeah. Kent is well known for amplifiers now as well. Apparently of premium quality.
Well, you've got Kef.
Yeah, Kef not too far away. Yeah.
And Cord Electronics.
Is that right? Cord's in Kent, are they? Yeah. Okay, right here.
Yeah, I actually share the my production facility. The engineering guys who do the casework, they actually made Cord CD player casework.
Nicely done. You dropped that smoothly into the conversation.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just saying it's.
Well, their casework is quite amazing. Quite often it's quite extravagant, isn't it? So
definitely, yeah, very bold design there.
Yeah, yeah, okay, all right. Well, that's kind of what I'm talking about, really, is that you've got these other manufacturers who need these services, as do no doubt there's all sorts of other things made that require quality machining. So it's completely impressive. So when you got the first K105 is the preamp, K135 is the integrated, which I guess is largely the same, but with some ice modules. And I don't want to imply, oh, you just drop some ice modules in, because obviously, clearly, there needs to be a power supply for them, it's a different product. But when did you manage to get those sort of kind of fully resolved and out onto the market?
There was a little hiatus.
All right.
For a few years, and I don't mind sharing this story because everyone always asks, well, hang on, you launched this references to your product in 2015, and then there's more recent activity. And basically,
you went on a holiday.
Yeah. No, well, I wish. No, we ended up, I say, me and my wife had been trying for on and off for about 10 years to have some kids, and we didn't. And then I literally just launched the brand, and then we found out she was pregnant.
Delacord loudspeakers. No, I'm not going to tell you about how they're made in Australia, they're designed in Australia, and they're very high quality and they sound great. I'm not going to talk about that. $3,000 for the new 70S is great value for money, and the people that heard them at the Melbourne show when we released them the other day loved them. At $16.99, you can buy the ready-to-assemble kit. All the hard work is done, crossovers are assembled, cable looms are made, there's connectors fitted, soldering's all done. All you have to do is glue 6 pieces of wood together twice, one for the left and one for the right. The phone number's on the website, delacord.com.au, or of course email us, or any other way you care to get in touch. Release a carrier pigeon with a small moat attached to its foot. We'll send you our 5-page PDF with all of the details. Thanks for listening. Back to the show. And we're back. So, Gary, so you had a bit of a break create. Well, you'd already created the family to feed and nurture the family. At what point then did you – I mean, you said COVID was an interruption, so I'm guessing, 2022, 2023, you kicked it off again. Is that what happened?
We did, yeah. I'd had some data inquiries on and off over the years, kind of, you know. I just want to mention a good friend of mine, Andy Holt, who kind of has been a bit of a sort of mentor to me along the way. And he got in touch with me, like, in 2015 when we first sort of touched the market with the products.
Yes.
And he was the first person to see it, listen to it. He wanted to support it. But obviously we became quite good friends along the way, and we kind of had this thing of like, oh yeah, well, he just goes, just bring it down when it's ready, and all that kind of thing. So he was kind of my first thing. But with COVID, it was a difficult time, obviously, for lots of people in different ways. But there was in the UK, it was, you could buy stuff from a shop, but you couldn't go inside it and sort of demo the products. So it just seemed a bit fruitless to kind of trying to launch when people were just buying things that sold, like Name and Riga and Lin and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Just flying out the shop.
I mean, it was a great, you know, it was a great time to sell stuff, but you needed, it was, I guess a lot of it was being done online, and I guess because of that, it was known brands. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. So I thought it's pointless. So it got to the end of 2022, that around that time. And then we had stock made up, you know, after we ironed out all of our issues over the years and got something which was really happy with. And then that's when we started kind of pushing it, you know, kind of actually going, right, let's get it in front of retailers. And that's been a whole learning curve and a different experience on its own.
I'm sure it has. So yeah, have you been to any of the local shows, or have you just basically driven around the country and showed a few retailers your product, or what's the
I've got a couple of sales agents. Well, I've got one at the moment, because one guy had to, was doing it part time between another role. But they're kind of doing the rounds, going around to retailers and doing all that kind of stuff. But they work for other brands as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's kind of like you don't know how much airtime your product's getting, which is fine for me because I'm not trying to become a big manufacturer overnight. But
yeah, you're clearly not in a hurry. This is very well, and that's meant as a compliment, really. But the point is, you it's fitting in with your life, but it's also the for what you've done, you've turned nothing into something, and you just simply can't do it overnight. So when you finally get it more or less right, there's no point rushing it. And I guess I think if the product's as good as it looks, I mean, I haven't heard it, but I have little doubt of the quality of the way it's made. I've seen some pictures inside, etc. I suspect it will somewhat sell organically as word gets out. Is that kind of part of it?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And I'm not trying to run down kind of, you know, retailers, but there has been that thing of I want to, because I've put so much effort into it in my own, I'm not happy to just shift boxes and go to a lower margin, a bigger margin for the retailer in order to just get the sale. It's the kind of thing of like, look, this is who we are. This is what we're doing. Do you want to be part of a helping a brand over a longer period of time, you know, when we get the rest of our products out? And basically, the people on our website are listed so far, and we've got other demos and people buying demo kit already in the process. Yep. They're retailers who have kind of gone, yeah, I like what you're doing. I like what you stand for. We want to be part of it, help you out. And that's important to me, as opposed to having 200 retailers up and down the country just shifting boxes for the sake of it. I want someone to go in, make an informed decision on they want this product, and the retailer's really behind it, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a difficult needle to thread, so to speak, to know. Yeah, I mean, finding supportive, the right people that really, I guess, appreciate the work you've put in and what you've tried to create, which is becoming, just speaking generally, is it becoming less commonplace for all of those UK brands that we know to be made in the UK now? Is that, I mean, we know, just I mentioned Name before, and I have heard rumours that Name have moved some of their manufacturing away from Salisbury. Is this something that's happening across the country or you know?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose I'd keep myself in my own little bubble, to be honest. But I mean, I do hear similar sort of things. You know, some manufacturers are taking, they're using more sort of, I don't know, assembled in the UK as opposed to necessarily made in the UK.
There are brands
I actually do admire and all that kind of stuff.
Well, what are those brands? Yeah. I mean, because of Cord, I guess you know how good the casework is, but
definitely.
And they're obviously, because of that, clearly they're still largely made in the UK. I mean, you know, I open up pieces of equipment, and I mean, in fact, I bought a transformer the other day for an older musical fidelity that the guy really wanted to be fixed. The transformer had gone open circuit and was unrepairable at shorter turns. It doesn't matter, but I needed a transformer. I actually bought it out of the UK from a transformer maker, and I've forgotten their name now, but they clearly make toroidal transformers for a lot of different purposes. I mean, there's a couple of others that I saw in the process of Googling it, but that was the one that actually Musical Fidelity suggested I get in touch with, and they did a great transformer. Was great, and it fitted. It was almost exactly the same size as the original. So there's still lots of component manufacturing happening there, obviously. So
definitely.
So what the hell was my question? I don't know. I mean, well the products that you admire. That's right. That was what I was wondering.
Yeah.
I mean, you started it, so finish it.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, sorry. I better finish it. I don't know. Cord is a good example. I do like their casework. It's a bit, some of the design can be a bit controversial, but ultimately they're making a statement and they stuck with that kind of design. Yeah. I like that. But even other companies like Exposure, I think they're based, I think not. But the design is quite simple, I suppose you could call it that, and I don't mean that in a rude way.
No.
But they make a good sounding product, and it's all done here, you know. They don't have the big marketing thing of like Name and all them kind of guys, but they do make a. But the pricing is good. you know.
Yeah, they're pricing. Yeah, no, I'm familiar with, I know the brand, and I actually know Tony quite well. And
oh, you do?
Yeah, cool. And yeah, lovely product. Yeah, great sound. And, yeah. I believe, well, I mean, you know, I know they make them there. I mean, everyone buys in bits and pieces from places, I guess.
Of course.
And, but yeah.
We do the same. So,
yeah, of course. It's unavoidable. Yeah. It's not like everything is made in the UK. So, I'm pleased that you like that brand. I agree. It's a bit of a Exposure is a bit of a dark horse in a way, because when it started, I think the original the guy that started the company and Julian Verica at Name were kind of mates, and they weren't that far apart from each other, and started at the same time. But clearly the brands have taken two completely different paths ultimately, and sound
definitely
somewhat different. But yeah, one's super famous and one not so much, and yet both excellent products. So there's a lesson in that somewhere. I'm not sure what it is, but I mean, Julian was a huge personality, so maybe maybe that's part of it. I don't know, but yeah, Exposure's great. Is there any other brands that you spring to mind, or ones that you used to like, but they don't make the stuff there anymore? Is that part of it?
I suppose, like, I used to have. I still got it. I say I've got Musical Fidelity kit. I liked it.
Mm.
Obviously they've kind of been bought out when Anthony Michaelson, I think, you know, retired, and
yes,
the guys at Project sort of took it on. But it sort of sits in a funny place for me, because it's kind of, they're British, they still got British logos on their website.
Mm.
But I think a lot of the R&D now is done in Austria.
Mm, probably,
but it's still made in Taiwan. It's a bit sort of, what is it, man? Because I wouldn't have any objections to, you know, buying some more of their kit or whatever. I mostly use my own now. But it's that thing of, like, I don't know, what does it stand for? And that confuses me.
So that's an interesting point. So what does it stand for? Yeah, I mean, it's there is a strong history of UK brands disappearing offshore, but still flying the Union Jack high, and changing the terminology to, you know, designed and engineered in the UK or England, and it's not really the same thing. Yeah, so I'm trying to think of other brands. I mean, there's a lot of little brands still making electronics in the UK, obviously, and you're one of them. So, but there's others, and I'm not going to mention a whole string of them, but I guess it is now more the smaller brands that are making things locally. Is that your thought?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I know a couple of guys who make sort of phono stages and headphone amplifiers and things like that.
Okay.
And I talked to a few of these guys, and they're kind of at the £300 price point. Make it that, and that's great. They've got good businesses from that as well.
Yeah.
And and that's good. So yeah, but it is all happening. You know, I think maybe at the where you've got to be a bit more specialist and start trawling the audio forums to find all these little brands. But yeah, they're definitely out there.
Yes,
I think we're quite.
Do you think you will, from the point of view of getting the word out there, do you think you will go to, like, the Bristol show at some point or something like that, or is that not really?
I would like to. The problem I have with the shows, and I probably sound like some opinionated guy here.
Well, please do, because we like an opinion.
Okay, I struggle with the shows, to be honest, because I've been to a lot of them, and it's always the same kind of thing. You've got people collecting bags for all the brands, people playing dinner jazz, which I can't stand. And do you know what? I think I'd end up probably in an argument with someone, because I was at this show once.
Okay, yeah.
I was at this show once.
Yep.
It was this £500,000 Focal kind of setup with all this stuff. And this guy, they were playing some classical and jazz, and I was there as a punter as opposed to a manufacturer.
Mm.
And it was early 2011, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the bloke chips in, who's sitting down, says, "Oh, can you put some Beyonce on this, please?"
Yep.
And the bloke went, "No, we haven't got any of that."
Okay.
He went, "Oh, well." He goes, "Well, we don't play that type of music on this
system." We don't play that type of
and
music.
He said, "Well, if I was to spend this much money on a hi-fi, I want to hear what it sounds like." And they were like, no. Well, if you bought this system, maybe you'd start enjoying this type of music more. And the bloke was like, getting quite confrontational. And he said, and he was going, no, because I'd use this for my whole family. And if my daughter wants to listen to Katy Perry and my wife wants to listen to this, this is the type of music we're going to be using.
And he said,
well, no, we haven't got that type of music. And this other guy chips in and said, calm down. He's not trying to cause an argument. And I thought, this is just the pinnacle of, like, what goes on here. You know, every room you go into has got, I don't know, Miles Davies playing or something. And it's like, I walked down the row of a corridor of a show once, and someone had some Lady Gaga playing.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, here we go. This is what.
Finally.
Because
yeah, okay.
In reality, this is what people use their music systems for.
Yeah.
I don't own any jazz music or anything. I'm not running it down. But when I get a Clio prototype here, and I've, you know, when I've had one back from a retailer visit before it goes out again or something, and I wire it up.
Yeah.
My wife's got, I don't know, God knows what, on some sort of, like, you know, R&B from the 90s, or I've got, you know, some rock music or something, you know, and the kids have got their My Little Pony soundtrack playing for it. You know, that's, but because that's reality. That's really what these systems are for, you know, let's have some fun with it. You know,
yeah,
so I kind of avoid the shows just because I find them a little bit kind of clicky but it is a good way of getting out there. So
you're in front of a certain audience by the sound of it. But what so you're not a fan of the term audiophile, is that
that's correct. I can't stand that term.
Okay.
Oh, you've hit the nail on the head now, Andrew. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, there are people listening, of course, but they're
of course,
and yeah. Some of those
no
people,
offense to the listeners.
But the thing is, it is the thing. I don't know. We're having a bit of a joke when we say not an audiophile, but we're really saying, you know, that we're in the trade, you know, so we kind of are audiophiles in a way, but I guess we're very serious and we're sort of everything sort of a performance orientated audiophile, although audiophiles would say that they are performance orientated, but I mean, sticking to the laws of physics fairly closely and, you know, I guess, but it's not just that. It's kind of having a crack at the term, but not really, because it's now, bizarrely, and probably has been for 10 or more years, in quite common usage, you know, and not in a way that's any way disparaging. Whereas back when I started in this audio business, it was kind of a term used. And this is the problem. If you're of a certain age, you remember when the term was disparaging, really. Oh, here comes another audiophile, you know, like, it's not like that anymore. But it is quite funny, in some ways, to hear it used in a way that, you know. But you're obviously thinking of the term applying to a particular segment of audio equipment enthusiast. Can you lay some meat on the bones? Elaborate a little, yeah.
I suppose it's at the end of the day, I got into this because I like music.
Yes.
And hi-fi gives me a good route to get the best out of the music.
Right? Yep.
So that's my position. And I think realistically, a lot of people use that what it's for. But it's come a bit of a kind of, I won't use the term I was going to use, but kind of, let's treat all the high. Okay, well let's treat hi-fi as like a penis extension. So let's kind of
okay. So what do you? Hang on a second. Do penis extensions exist? Is that what you're saying? I want to know more. Well, I need to know more about this.
So. I don't know. I'm not a consumer, but you know, in fact,
you're comfortable. Keep going.
But it's that kind of thing of, oh well, my system's not as good as yours because I'm using these cable lifters what cost £100 for a bit of wood, you know. And it's kind of arguing amongst each other. And do you know what? Yeah. If you wanna spend your money on that stuff, brilliant. That's great. I'm sure the companies who make this stuff aren't going to complain.
No.
But it becomes this kind of inner sort of fighting kind of thing about people just running down equipment for the sake of it. Whereas, like, are you actually listening to the kit? Because I don't know if you are. And I think, and I see it in other kind of things. I do a bit of cycling, you know, and I just go out on my bike and ride for like 12 miles at a time and get some fresh air and clear my head from whatever's going on, right?
Yep, yep.
But then you find that the enthusiasts go, oh, you shouldn't be riding that bike. And why are you using them tires? And why are you not wearing this stuff? And it's like, I just want to enjoy my bike.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the hi-fi stuff. And I think, I know there's a market to be made from selling all the accessories and all that stuff. And I get that. That's great.
Yeah.
But I do find that when it becomes kind of you're losing purpose of what it's for, what the hi-fi is for, then are you getting actual enjoyment from it? And I don't know. And I think that damages, I think, for me, the industry perception.
I think from an outsider's point of view, you know, the outsider's looking in at some kind of, you know, and so, yeah, it's interesting. You're describing the term and what you don't like about it largely the way I don't really care that people want to use cable lifters, but...
Mm.
Which is, you know, from my point of view, is kind of funny. But you know, but the thing is, but I don't care that they do. You make hi-fi, which is a good old term, you make it look a bit silly when people look in as music lovers into the hi-fi world or the audiophile world. We all, not you or I, but the ones that are going on about the particular brand of cable lifter that works, these other ones are rubbish. I mean, I don't know if they do that, but I mean, you're implying they do, and that's scary. I mean, if I found that on the internet, I would clearly turn away because that is an argument about 0.00001% difference, which I'm just not interested in because these same people probably have diabolical acoustics in their listening room. They probably don't, but they, one thing's for sure, you could tweak the acoustics a little, improve the sound a lot, whereas the cable lifter thing, that's the bit that does my head in, is the tweakiness of it, but the not perhaps prioritizing the tweaks, you know, successfully.
I agree, and I think there's a big perception that, you know, no I agree, and I think there's that big thing of, you know, oh, but manufacturers must be using these really expensive cables and rooms to do all their tuning and all that kind of stuff. And I think reality, it's that kind of, I'm not trying to, you know, to tell everyone that Father Christmas isn't real or anything like that, but reality is that kind of, you know, that's not really how products are developed, you know, the manufacturers aren't using £10,000 speaker cables to necessarily test their stuff. They're using, I use basically bell wire to start with, you know, because I think you could, if you can get it sounding good on the rubbish stuff.
I'm absolutely with you. We use very simple cables when developing a speaker because there's a good chance that if you put a really fancy cable on it, it will only improve it, and it will improve it by some margin. But you need to start you need to use a cable that's appropriately priced for the price of the product. In the case of your amplifiers, you're not going to put a £2,000 set of cables on them, right? I mean, that would be ridiculous. So, you know.
I use some Supra bi-wide cables, which I got about 20 years ago.
Yep.
And I'm quite happy to admit the kit we use. I use my speakers, which I use for testing, are a tenth of the price of the amplifier I'm selling. So I use an old set of Bowers & Wilkins 602S3s. All the time, and
people are falling down around their Wi-Fi speaker or whatever they're listening on,
and a set of Dali Zenza ones, which I picked up for about £150 from Richer Sounds. Because realistically, you know, although I'm in the trade, I can get a discount. I don't have all the funds to keep investing in speakers. And for me, I use these speakers for 20 years. I know how they sound, you know. For me, I can put a bit of Clio kit on it and go, right, okay, this sounds good. I can hear the improvement here, X, Y, and Z. But then also let the retailer have the magic of exploring how that sounds. You know, I went to a retailer once and we tried everything. We had Spendors, we had audio vectors, we had some Dyne audios, and it was like, oh, okay, right. And they enjoyed their journey when I was there for about 3 hours. It was kind of, oh, this sounds good with this. Let's try this one now. Can we try this? And it's kind of they are then specking the system for a customer based on what they think works well with the kit. For me, I just need to know it makes decent sounding audio before I commit to the design kind of stage.
No. So, I think you the bit that's most important that you said is that you know how those loudspeakers sound. You've been listening to them for years on all sorts of different things, and that's it's no different to an audio engineer knowing his monitors well. He doesn't need the latest monitor. Yep. He needs the one that he knows how things need to sound on that, so they sound right when the finished product is played on something else. And this applies equally to what you're doing. So, I mean, you are the wizard, to use your previously mentioned term, as far as voicing the way that amplifier works, or at least making sure that the design sounds the way you wanted it to and that it's fun to listen to. And, you'd be silly to actually listen to it on a fancy loudspeaker that you're not familiar with how it performs. And you're right. Then you go to a retailer and you can mix up a potion of whatever works together. As a matter of interest, so what's the general feedback when you take an amplifier out to a retailer? Is there a little bit of surprise that the thing sounds as good as it does?
Surprise
is maybe the wrong word, but you're selling them. These people are buying them off you, and they're selling them to customers. So clearly, they're very happy with the performance.
Well, one guy I spoke to, he used to be a name rep, and he came over and he's wired it up, he's plugged it in, he's played about 5 minutes of music, and come over and shook my hand and said, "You've done an absolutely amazing job, mate, based on what you've come from and what you've made." Yep. And I felt a bit emotional at that point.
You would.
Wow, this guy sells, top end kit for the last, however many years.
Yep.
And I just kind of, things like that. Some things have gone well, some things have gone bad. One guy said it was the worst amplifier he's ever heard in his whole life.
My God, really? Don't fast forward over that. You made a time. You went there with your gear. He had a listen to it.
I didn't. My agent did.
Oh, your agent did. Okay. Yeah.
And then he rung me up and said that demo didn't go well. And I said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, he listened to it. We was there for about 2 hours, and he said it was the worst amplifier he's ever heard in his life." And I said, "Oh, okay, fine. Well, thanks for the positive feedback." Because at the end of the day.
He's like
cars, and I think I've heard you mention it before on your podcast. People think different opinions, different cars. But what the ironic thing about that was, though, at that point, we hadn't had any press reviews.
Okay,
but when I won the best of 2023, from the year, they got on the phone and said, "Oh, could you come back and give us another demo?"
Oh, and I was like, "Is that no. right?"
Yeah, I said no, because I don't think you get two bites of a cherry on that. Because, at the end of the day, if you was that happy, if you liked it, you should have, like I've said about retailers, buying into it and kind of supporting the brand. Actually, okay, fine. We can set it on its own merit without the reviews. These guys just wanted reviews to kind of back it and then try it. And I thought, no, do you know what? No. Maybe in a couple of years' time, when I've stopped being angry about it, I'll let you go.
No, don't. Isn't it?
But at the moment, I was like, no, actually, no. You've had your chance, and you've wasted time. My guys had to go out there, use fuel and stuff, and he's come away with no sales. So, yeah. Worst amplifier he's ever heard in his life. So.
Interesting that he comes up with that bold statement. And which is clearly ridiculous because, the worst amplifier he would have heard in his life is probably something made by Sanyo about 45 years ago with 8 watts, with germanium transistors or something. But anyhow, so
amazing.
So he isn't it funny that he makes that bold statement, but it sounds like it was not, I don't know, was it more of a, I don't know, it's somewhat divisive. How did the amplifier sound change because it won an award? That tells you a little bit about that retailer, and I guess I was going to say, I almost said golden ear, which is a terrible term in itself, and comes back to the audiophile thing a bit. But I mean, clearly he doesn't trust his own judgment. It was safer for him to say it was bad than say that an unknown product was good, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, or that it would be difficult for him to maybe sell to his customer base. Everyone's got their own, but, people know who comes in the door regularly and all that kind of stuff. So maybe that was it. But I've been quite, with all these retailers, I've kind of been a bit too friendly, as I've been told, because I let people have it on demo without any real time for commitment. You know, I think most of the thing is, you know, you have it for a couple of days and say, I want it back. And buying one? Yes or no? I kind of just let them have it for a couple of weeks, you know, because I don't want to be Mr. Pushy. That's not really what I'm about. And I know it's one retailer who's on our website. I won't name them. They just said, you've been really ambitious with what you're doing, and we really support that. And I was like, yes. And that's my downfall, because I'm kind of like, yeah, after product for 2 weeks, don't worry about buying it or not, you know. So I know that these are lessons I've learned along the way. But retail has been I'm juggling a lot of things, really. I'm juggling design, marketing.
Oh, you certainly are.
Finance.
Someone's got to write the instruction manual. Who did that?
I wrote the instruction manual, and it was quite good because at the same time we wrote it, I was doing the EMC and all the CE compliance stuff. Yeah, so it was a case of I got the guy to make sure that the user manual was conformant with all of the current standards you have to put in the user manual and all that kind of stuff at the same time. Was writing some stuff, you know, it was right. And I wrote, it was quite a learning curve because I wrote something. The guy said, you need to add this in. And I said, I think it was along the lines of, make sure you switch off the power before, or something along the lines of, don't cut the cable if it's still plugged into the mains. And I said, what idiot is going to do that? Right. And I have to find the reference. And the guy said, you've got to treat everybody as an idiot. Even if it sounds ridiculous, you've got to put it in black and white unless you want to get sued. And I was like, but Colin, I said, no one would do that, would they? And he's like, don't ask Gary. I've been involved in all the lawsuits and stuff and things like this in the past. Just put it, for the sake of a line of text, just write it in there. And I was like, fine. Okay.
It's a bit like the, are you familiar with the meme? I'm going to lower ourselves and mention a meme. There's a picture of like a a Honda 4 of, you know, from the 70s, and the meme says something like, when this bike came out, there was a whole chapter on how to adjust the valve clearances. On the new model Honda, it mentions don't drink the contents of the battery. Times have changed, I guess. Although, you know, there's always been silly people around cutting power cords with the power still on, I guess. Or has there?
Yeah.
It seems hard to believe. Well. But it is the world we live in. And look, you've only got to write it once, you know. So, you know, the pain has been suffered and it's done. Hey,
Yeah, that's true.
There's things we could talk about for hours, and I mean, boring things that perhaps people don't want to hear about. And I mean, packaging is another thing that's such an important part of a product, and yet it kind of gets potentially tossed away on the same day as someone takes the product home. So, but you've got to get it from A to B in a way that it won't damage the amplifier, and of course, also that it looks kind of nice when you unpack it. And no doubt you've employed a packaging professional there, but we're not going to go down that path. I was just going to say, look, we probably should wrap things up, but is there something else that you'd like to mention? And of course, there's no reason why we can't chat in the future. This is not the end of we will never speak again, because I feel like when you bring out your power amplifiers, which I notice on the website are coming soonish. I don't know when, but do you have any? Is that getting closer, the power amp models?
Yeah. So obviously, given our size, when we designed the actual kind of roadmap for the product, the numbering is kind of was, you know, some people might recognize it, but I kind of used to use like the BMW kind of numbering sort of thing.
Is that what it relates to? Yeah.
Okay, right. Yeah. So I kind of like, it was K1 was like, one was the first series, and then it was kind of like, the middle number sort of indicated sort of what was in it.
A bigger engine.
The five was like, oh, it's an amplifier, you know, for example. So I'll just put that on there. And then basically the preamp was 105 because it hasn't got any power amp modules in it. And then one was going to be the mono, two was going to be the dual mono, and then the three was just the integrated because it's like the all-in-one sort of, like, you know, unit. But the 115 and the 125, it's just been one of them things whereby, you know, we're only small, we need to grow. We're quite open with this. We know we're looking at getting some investment for this business to really sort of turbocharge our efforts.
Yeah, okay.
And that's kind of going to be good for us. And it means that we can get all of these products which people keep asking for. We go to a retailer with an integrated and a pre, and they go, "Where's the power amps?" And we go,
that's sort of
in development.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And they are in development. They're 90% done. I just haven't got the casework finished for them. So it's that kind of thing where once we grease the wheels with our integrated and pre, then we can sort of quickly get the power amps out. But I've got a DAC which has already been done, and that's going to be a slotting kind of upgrade to the 135. You'll be able to sort of that input 7, which is basically just like an MP3 connection, because I needed a spare connection on the board, has actually got ability to plug a DAC into that socket. So going to be there. The same with the 105. I've got a headphone amp coming out eventually, and a phono stage. But it's just a case of getting more momentum behind the brand as well. And then for me to kind of go, right, let's, you know, if things improve, funding comes in, let's kind of bring all this stuff to the market. And then hopefully, you know, we'll be sitting here in a few years' time and saying, yeah, that Clio brand, yeah, they're making waves in the industry.
Look, you have made a wave. It's just that it's probably not left the shores of Great Britain just yet, because other than obviously by the power of the internet. But I mean, is export something that in due course you no doubt would embrace that, because it's the way forward, I guess, it's the way you grow a brand, but it's not something you perhaps thought about much at the moment. But I mean, you've got so much of it right. It looks, I mean, let's just summarise, because I probably should wrap things up with, I'm sure, you know.
Sorry,
don't apologise. It's a super interesting conversation, at least for me. Hopefully it is for the listeners as well. But it's, so do I. I really do. You've done it so logically. So you've got the styling right. You employed a professional. It's beautifully made. I mean, these are things, and of course, all reports is it sounds fantastic. So, I mean, these are the three key things, I guess. But the thing is, it does have to look good. It is such an important thing. And so that you've taken the time and you've got that right. So, and once you've got that basic styling, I guess the power amps fall into line and probably look similar, I guess. excuse me. But and then you're talking about taking in some investment and I guess productionizing things or speeding up production. Yeah. Okay. In fact, I think
a bit more control. Yeah.
You've actually got bigger premises. You've got premises these days, or you're not still building them on the dining room table, right?
No, I don't know. I don't build anything on the dining room table. Actually, I'll say my subcontractor who does all the PCB design, not design, sort of manufacturing, because obviously, you know, they've got the right kit for that.
Yes.
They do all of the assembly. So what I do is I get all parts shipped to them.
Okay.
And then they do it as a sort of packaging, box it, you know, away, out we go, you know, that kind of stuff. So
it's a smart way to do it. Because you don't need a giant factory, so really that you can grow the business without any big jumps in investment, I guess, to some degree, where you've got to, you don't have to buy or not.
And
buy,
I don't want, but, you know, I pay a fixed price for a finished packaged product as opposed to paying staff and having the relevant health and safety insurance and all that kind of stuff, you know. So I do pay a premium there, but in some ways, but I know that if there's any faults and stuff, I can just go back to and say, what's happened here? You know, you can sort it out. It's not got a disciplined staff and getting put on a course to learn how to solder properly.
Well, you know where you stand as far as your costs. That you can't lose money effectively. So Now, look, Gary, I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I'm pretty sure the listeners will as well. It's an interesting story. I mean, it's a big part of your life, obviously, to make that decision to do it, and then you've actually done it, which is you know, very impressive. And congratulations on getting it to the point where it exists and you've got in retailers, because it's not you and I know how hard it is to do, as anyone else who's started with nothing and tried to, nothing in the sense of a clean sheet of paper, and try to take something from your imagination and make it real. And it's, of course, very satisfying. So good on you. And
thank you so much.
A pleasure. And thanks for your time. And we will speak again soon. Anyone who's, when I say soon, it could be, well, it'll be, it might be power amplifier time. Who knows? And that sounds like that's about 6 months away or something. But
you never know.
If people have got questions, and they may well have questions, Clio is, which is Kleio, is, I guess, .co.uk. I forgot to check the URL.
.com. It's, yeah, it's
just straight .com. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I thought I'd go big, you know.
Yeah, you're planning on exporting to the US. So,
domination.
Well, indeed, yeah. So that's where there's further information. We're obviously going to have pictures when the podcast goes up, so people will know how good the amplifiers look. But more information there, the awards, reviews, what have you. And I was just going to say, if anyone's got questions, of course they can email you, but they could ask them on our YouTube YouTube channel, where this podcast will also be. No one really listens to audio only files on YouTube, but it is a great place to put comments and ask questions. So I will wrap up this time. Thank you, Gary. Interesting conversation, and thanks again, and have a great day.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Andrew. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure.